Hi, welcome to our Easter episode 69 of Inside Learning for the 4th of April 2012. Danger Mouth. Good evening, gentlemen. Here we are again, another episode of Inside Learning, and an exciting episode tonight. We've got a friend of the podcast and regular special guest, David Cameron, with us. But first, let me introduce Steve Rogers from sunny or cold, I don't know, Birmingham. How are you doing, Steve?
Freezing cold. We're getting your northeasterly winds with a hint of snow, just the wee touch.
Oh, that's a shame. We're actually big-hearted here. We don't really want to export it to you, but well, I guess it'll do you some good. It'll toughen you up.
Aye.
And Jay, joining us again tonight. We missed you last week. How are you?
I'm good, thanks, Matthew. All the better for the rest. I'm raring to go.
Yeah, I don't have to ask you about the weather. We live about 4 miles apart, don't we? So I think nice actually covers it today. We've had good weather, haven't we?
It was fresh, it was clear, and this was the second day in a row I've been out in the garden. I think I've racked up about 40 hours in the garden over the past week or so, so I've got biceps like Popeye.
Fantastic. And David, does the Easter break at schools mean anything to you, or are you still applying your olfactory equipment to the grindstone?
Indeed, and doing some catching up. It's been good. I've been replying to emails. I've been lying for far too long.
Right. Do you miss being a director of education, David, or is it good to have a different pace of life?
I miss elements of it. I miss being part of a team, and I miss being able to do things directly and very quickly. And I guess I miss the regularity of it and the paychecks. All of these things, I think, I miss.
Yeah.
But there's so many compensations in what I'm doing now.
Well, Inside Learning is able to fulfil two of those missing ingredients for you. shall we just check the football news? I have to let them get this out of their system, David.
No
news.
No, we're not tonight. No, we're keeping Sturm tonight. We've got to think of our listeners, haven't we?
Yeah, let's not even name one of our listeners tonight.
Can I request that we put on a link to the league table as it stands at this present moment in time?
Why? Why?
On the website. Well, because we are briefly above Liverpool in the league, and it's probably not going to last very long, and it doesn't happen very often.
Okay. Or could we just find a picture of a Cheshire cat and post that on the site with your name under it instead?
That'll do.
Okay. Anyway, let's crack on for our Easter holiday edition of Inside Learning. And hey, we didn't do it last year, so we're getting more serious, guys. Let me go to Steve first. What's caught your eye?
Well, it has to be the wackoidal one again, doesn't it? And the A-level story.
Interesting. I don't know if you
caught up with this one. Obviously it's created quite a lot of common debate. And the latest is that heads, universities and examiners are all a bit concerned about it. The interesting point for me about this is not so much setting up an exam that's a gold standard, but the fact that he's saying this is a non-political move. I mean, how naive is this guy? Because, because the whole way that the grade inflation, you know, the way that the education system is going is highly political. I mean, once upon a time, satisfactory used to be good enough, fair enough in inspection. Now it's no longer going to be good enough. Once upon a time, a C grade at GCSE used to be a grade one CSE, was a perfectly respectable result. It's no longer going to be respectable. Now our A levels aren't up to the scratch. So actually what we're doing is moving, you know, we're inflating all these grades and we're going to leave more and more young people behind in the qualification system. I have absolutely no, I've got no qualms about having, you know, a high level gold standard sort of A level exam in which universities are involved in, but how do you get universities to sit around the table and agree what the syllabus is going to be? You know, are you going to say that, well, if Cambridge University set an A-level, is that going to be better than, say, I don't know, Birmingham's A-level? I mean, how's this? Anyway, sorry.
I noticed it mentioned the Russell Group again there, Steve. What was their role in that?
Well, the Russell Group are considered to be obviously the kind of top-notch universities, and I mean, there's quite a lot of discussion about whether young people in certain subjects are coming out of A levels prepared enough for their degree courses. I think some of the Russell Group universities feel that some students have to be taught basically from scratch, you know, that the A levels aren't actually doing anything for them. And there probably is some merit in that argument. It's just that I just find it a bit ironic that Gove has sort of announced this as a kind of step back from government. You know, this is a non-political move, whereas in fact we've not had the political discussion about what our education and qualification strategy is.
Okay. Anyone else got any quick thoughts on that one?
Well, I just think that's a brilliant illustration of a dangerous idea. Michael Gove intends to fill the curriculum with knowledge. It's going to be a knowledge-based curriculum. And now he's telling us that he's going to extend the A-levels to make sure that they test the broad range of skills that are required for youngsters to take on further learning. So curriculum for excellence at one end and curriculum for the last century at the other. It's a really dangerous idea.
Mm. Yeah.
There's a link there, of course, because our theme tonight is dangerous ideas, but we'll come back to that later, David. Jay, any thoughts on that? Obviously, you're one of only half of our cast here who actually did A-levels.
Yeah, I did A-levels when they were A-levels.
Yeah, before the AS and modularisation, etc.
Oh, before all these A-stars and all the rest of it. I just think it's fine. You keep on inventing new words, you know. A-star, super-duper A-star, trilla-brill A-star. Yeah, keep going.
Hmm. Well, I guess my kind of feeling on it, Steve, is that it's always depressing to see the universities driving policy like that, you know, much as I think they're important. You know, the A-levels are the lingua franca of all senior pupils, really, in schools, whether they should be or not in England, aren't they?
Yeah, I don't think the universities so much are driving it. I think they're a bit kind of fazed by this, you know, sudden wooing from Gove. I think they're a bit caught out by it. Mm. And it's just, I don't know, it's just that if we valued, you know, if we'd say go back to the Tomlinson report and the kind of whole notion of diplomas and, you know, what's our qualification system for? What it seems to be, as David quite rightly said, is this kind of last century notion that actually we need to look after that 2% who are going to go into our elite universities and you can stuff the rest of them, you know.
Sure. Oh, well, thanks, Steve. Yep, slightly depressing from Gove. David, could I come to you now? What's caught your eye this week?
One of the things I'm really excited about is the series of creative conversations that are going on in Edinburgh just now, and I've been closely involved in that. We've got a brilliant one coming up on the 24th of April with Graham Tidyman, obstetrician, sculpture, inventor, and he's going to talk about the Leonardo effect. And we want to explore the whole idea of creativity being contagious, and Graham's just a brilliant example of it. We're also hoping to have Jemima Anderson, who's a teacher in East Wren, and she's been involved with an organisation called the Leonardo Effect. We're looking at spreading creativity from the arts into science, technology, all the STEM subject areas. And I think that's going to be a really exciting evening. They're following on from brilliant conversation last week where we had Simon Sharkey from National Theatre of Scotland talking about the Transform Project. We had Maureen Finn talking about the Fife Earth Project and all the brilliant resources associated with that. And Stephen Bullock from Creative Scotland talking about the Creativity Portal. And it was just so good to hear so many positive views, hear so much good information and see such wonderful resources that are available to support people in schools who want to do things just a bit differently.
Fantastic. One of my first questions, I know I asked you earlier, David, you know, what the view is like post-directorship, you know, as you've moved into being a consultant and kind of an advisor. Gun for hire is in my mind there. What's your view of how creative councils are as organisations? You know, if this great work is happening and, you know, certain people are being hugely influenced by this, is it percolating through?
I think it varies. I've been really impressed in Edinburgh. Gillian T, the director, has absolutely picked up on what's going on in these conversations, and she's asked to be more involved. So she'll be present at the next one. She's already been at one, and she'll be part of the roundup at the end, talking about how Edinburgh are going to take the messages from these conversations forward. So I've been really excited about that. I think we've seen huge elements of creativity in things like Aberdeenshire's approach to GLOW. I think we've seen it with North Lanarkshire cooperative learning. I think we've seen it in a number of areas, but it's not consistent. And I think sometimes people feel that the creativity that's there within schools and within individual teachers is sometimes not being given the encouragement it should from the local authority level.
Okay. David, before we move on, how can people tap into this? Are these conversations available online or in any other format, or do you have to actually go?
Yeah, they're being filmed, and the film will go up on the Creativity Portal when it's completed. And we're trying to get as many as possible of the speakers involved in the Scottish Learning Festival. The theme of that's creativity. And I've been tweeting over the last couple of weeks saying, if that's the theme, then let's see some artists working, let's see some open performance spaces, some flash mobs, let's make it a festival that demonstrates creativity rather than a series of seminars and keynotes where we talk about it.
Yeah, of course, your comments and that brought me out of my Twitter torpor. And I did make some kind of a comment about agreeing entirely with that, but wishing that we could have some creativity that was not just arts and performance.
Absolutely, and I will have my obstetrician there if it kills me.
An unfortunate image, really. Be just happy if an obstetrician didn't say it about you, David.
I thought of a creative obstetrician, but he's well worth hearing.
Okay. Anyone else want to add anything to that one? Hello, is everyone there? Sorry, everyone, I don't know if it was my bandwidth there or something went wrong, but Skype suddenly disappeared and hung. So just picking up again, David, from your thoughts on the obstetrician and creativity.
Yeah, I'm just saying that we're hoping to have him along at the Scottish Learning Festival, and we're hoping to get more of that cross-subject element. That's partly why we've got the Leonardo effect, people coming along to the next session, because I think they do that and do it really well.
Mm. Excellent. Okay, thanks very much. And are there links that you can put up for us on this one, David?
Yeah, will do. I'll put up the links for that, and certainly would direct everybody to the Creativity Portal. It's a really good resource.
Okay. Jay, do you mind if I just pop in my story here, because it links quite well with that one?
Please do.
Yeah, okay. I don't know if you noticed that there's been a report from Royal Society of Edinburgh which has identified that there's a female talent drain in Scottish science. And essentially what they're saying is, while there are plenty of female students with a maths, science, technology or engineering qualification, they don't tend to stay in employment that's relevant to their qualifications. So, for example, even if you look at something like, professors of physics, there's a lovely quote from the report. It says, in 1991, the number of female professors of physics in the UK doubled. It went from 1 to 2. By 2009 to 2010, it had risen to 36. Big improvement, but that's out of 650 professors of physics nationally. There's just one little bit that kind of leapt out. But the RSE president, Sir John Arbuthnot, has said that shortages are being reported now by employers. And of course, they're also flagging up impending shortages of people with these qualifications. And what they're just saying is that there might be something odd going on here, whereby we actually have a lot of talent that we're not using. could it be cultural? You know, the report says, is it that the role models aren't there? That, you know, even if you get a degree in engineering as a woman, you still tend to aspire to what, you know, what other women do, and there aren't many female role models doing that. Could it be that we've got a culture that's sexist, at, you know, at some institutional level, whereby it's pretty hard for you to get on and be celebrated without being treated as a sort of a token female, you know? So I just thought it was a really interesting report, throws up a lot of questions. I suppose the link there for me, David, was, you know, I'm always passionate as a science and engineering fan, and an art fan, I have to say as well, you know, that, you know, the guys that are, and I do mean guys in the generic sense, I'm not doing any help here, am I, to the female cause, you know, the putting together the Airbus or the new Boeing Dreamliner, you know, that's creativity on a grand scale, solving problems that have never been done before, you know, it's wonderful stuff. So it's an interesting story. What do you think?
Absolutely. I think it's hugely important that we do something to reverse that trend. We've had, I think, the last two science advisors have both been women, and I think they have real potential to have an impact, because we do need to get more girls, more women involved in science and in engineering, and we need the role models there to do that.
Yeah.
Matthew, did you say that there was a shortage in girls signing up for degree courses in these subjects, or more it was more an issue of a shortage of them going on to become professors in the subjects?
It's a little of both, but it's mostly the latter. The professorships weren't the issue. It was more that, you know, the female students don't tend to go on to use their discipline directly. So, for example, you know, you might do your degree in mechanical engineering, but end up working in the finance sector, you know, because you've got a numerate degree. Whereas a higher proportion of men who get that mechanical engineering degree might end up actually doing mechanical engineering or something closely related.
Right. Okay. Do you think we still are there as a society? You know, where some institutions or some academic fields are, you know, still a boys' club.
Well, I think it's possible, you know, and I think this report certainly raises that question. But you know, I'm interested in your views.
Yeah, well, do you know, it's strange, because do you remember Anne, writer girl Anne Glennie, who's a regular guest of the cast, brought that up to us and said, you know, I think apart from Anne, we've only ever had three other female guests.
Yeah, that's true, actually. We don't tend to have as many female guests. And hey, are we institutionally sexist in Inside Learning? This is a worry.
Sorry, David? I'm just going to change.
Please welcome Davina Cameron.
An improvement in McCall.
So, Steve, any observations on this one?
No, I don't know. It's hugely complex. I suspect that also it takes a long time, doesn't it? You know, to change attitudes and change habits, customs. I was just reflecting in, you know, what's come out about the police recently, you know, how, you know, that kind of level of racism is still there.
Yeah.
You know, after all the stuff that's gone on, the Lawrence, you know, in the case of Stephen Lawrence. And so I guess, you know, sexism and the kind of male, I don't know, our science is seen as a kind of more male orientated. And why should that be? And presumably that's socially constructed, isn't it? It doesn't sort of rest on the natural talents of either men or women, or dispositions of men or women towards certain subjects.
No, I guess you're right. Certainly if you look at schools, which is, you know, the end that we have more knowledge of and influence, you know, if you look at science departments, it is still true, isn't it, that, you know, you're more likely to have a female biology teacher and you're more likely to have a male physics teacher. You know, although that's maybe improved a little, I don't think it's significantly changed. So there are some things that are institutional. Anyway, big questions, probably a whole, you know, whole area all to itself. Jay, what's caught your eye?
Yeah, what caught my eye, I was doing a troll through the usual news agencies online earlier today, and so many stories relating to the annual conference of the Association of Teachers and Lecturers, the ATL, quite a few relating to Dr. Mary Bousted, who's the head of the union, the association. She talked about a few things. One of them was that schools in the UK are still segregated along class lines, which is a situation that's toxic for poor children. You know, now there are a lot of a lot has been highlighted about how young black boys in particular are struggling in education. Young poor black boys, I should say. What about young poor white boys and young poor everybody else? And one thing she says quite categorically is that the government, both of the Michaels, need to, you know, stop blaming teachers for poor results and failure, and to take cognizance of the fact that social factors have a big a lot to play in achievement and attainment, and that as long as we've got schools where, you know, some schools are predominantly white middle class, and some schools are predominantly you know, multi-ethnic, and some schools are predominantly poor, you know, draw from poor families, as long as that's happening, we don't have integration of the classes, in inverted commas, you know, then that's not going to change or improve. The other thing she said was she had a go at middle class parents, who she accused of raising little Buddhas, children who parents are waiting on hand and foot, and these kids are not developing any kind of life skills or resilience or any of these kind of things which are vital for achievement. So a real kind of a shot across the bows in general by Dr. Bousted in her closing speech to the conference.
Fascinating stuff. It's interesting that you know, she's made this comment about the little Buddhas, because so many of our schools these days are running Buddha systems, aren't they, between the kids. I hope that's not going to exacerbate the problem.
I wondered what male siblings had to do.
Sorry, David. Listeners should know that I've just watched David rubbing his eyes in horror. Oh, dear. Yeah, well, in one hand, Jay, you know, it seems to be a statement of the obvious, doesn't it? You know, the only commentators that think that there isn't some sort of class divide in, you know, in terms of your geography or culture are Michael Gove and his pals, you know, and I think we can all tell that they don't even believe what they say themselves.
Yeah, well, there's also, I think there's a really kind of dangerous political story going on here as well, that, and it relates to my earlier one about the A-levels, that Michael Gove said, oh, the department, you know, is stepping back, is kind of depoliticizing the education system. Whereas in fact, it's doing quite the contrary, because what will happen is, you know, when these schools don't lift children out of poverty, or when these schools don't meet the targets that he sets, it's the teachers and the school's fault. It's not the government's fault anymore. You know, so he's kind of, he's actually, you know, the blame has been kind of shifted on to parts of the system that, and I think it's a really kind of dangerous, more insidious move than, you know, kind of New Labour were bad enough at blaming teachers, but this lot seem to be kind of taking it a step further. And the other thing as well, I've read a really interesting report, research paper that said actually if all schools did improve to their maximum, the kind of ironic effect would be that actually the class system would become more stratified, because actually those coasting schools, those schools that are working with middle class children and are currently coasting, actually would kind of up the ante for the middle class, and the middle class would take advantage of the opportunities that were created, which I thought was rather an interesting ironic view on it.
Absolutely. There's also a paradox here, I think, as ever, you know, the International Futures Forum and all that stuff that Graham Lester's got us all thinking about, you know, about complexity and, you know, the difficulty of the modern world leaps to mind here, you know. In one hand, it's absolutely right that the government is shifting the blame. On the other hand, the answer to the problem might well be to break up these sort of slightly ghettoised schools and move them to some sort of different scheme. But actually, to do that without making it seem as if you're attacking the teachers that are running them, it's difficult. It seems to me there's a wee bit of a conundrum for us there.
Well, it's such a complex system, education. Like so many things, there are so many factors that impact on how well children achieve You know, there are internal factors, you know, for the children. Are there any particular special needs or anything like that? And then you've got the external factors to do with school, which are things like teacher skills. Because, you know, let's face it and be honest, there are some there are some teachers who are better at doing their job than others. And then you have other factors outside of that, you know, family situations, socioeconomic situations, geographical situations as well, and then you've got the kind of overarching on top of that is the current political climate or financial situation nationally or globally, all of which have an impact on what actually happens ultimately to the child in their education. And to say, you know, for Ofsted, for Wilshire or Gove to say, you know, it's all about the quality of teaching and we're not putting enough facts into these kids and why aren't they doing Latin and Greek in P1? You know, to take that kind of narrow view of it is to focus in and put an awful lot of pressure on just one impacting element. And if you put a lot of pressure on one part of a machine, it doesn't work at its optimum performance level.
No, I mean, the research on school effects, I mean, yeah, schools do have an effect, you know, but I mean, the methodology of school improvement has been questioned. Its political motives have been questioned, and you know, I think there's a huge amount of research to suggest actually if you're not tackling the causes of poverty outside of school, then there's a limit to what schools can do to raise children out of deprivation.
Well,
actually, what we need are some dangerous ideas.
Yeah, I mean,
exactly. Well, I think the last word on this one, David, go for it.
Well, I mean, I do think that the effect that schools can have is recognised, and I think it's important. And the reality is we need to make all the difference that we can. You can only pull the levers in which you can place your hand. And education has been a major factor that's caused economic breakthrough for families, for individuals, for communities. And we need to keep working at that. And that is about teacher quality. And it is about the efforts that we make within the schools. Schools can make a difference. They just can't make all the difference. And what we can't fall into the trap of is the Gove trap, I think, where he keeps trumpeting that social circumstances can never be an excuse for low attainment. Absolutely. But they are an explanation. And they are a reason why it's much more difficult to generate high levels of attainment in some schools and in some communities than others. And it's an explanation as to why we need to have a diverse approach in these communities so that we do focus our efforts on making what differences we can make.
Absolutely.
Sage words.
David, your sound broke up quite badly just there. So there's no chance, is there, that anyone suddenly done something on the internet in your house, is there, because it's been perfect up to this moment?
I don't think so. I don't think there's any change in the internet circumstance here.
Right, okay. So we'll press on to the next bit. But before we wrap up the news section, Jay, you mentioned Anne Glennie. Probably worth flagging up to people that are interested in Steve's ongoing praise for Michael Rosen. I think twice you brought up Michael Rosen's open letter, Steve.
Yeah.
Today, Michael Rosen engaged, or certainly today I heard about it, over the last couple of days, engaged in a little dialogue on Anne Glennie's blog about the big writing that she's involved in, which he'd criticised. She kind of attacked him in an open letter to him on her blog, and he's replied. They've had a bit of back and forward, so it makes very, very interesting reading, and I know it'll be right up your street, Steve. So if anyone's interested, get off to Anne's blog. The name escapes me, Jay. What is it?
It's Pandora's Pencil Case.
That's it. I always think of a writing blog first, rock, paper, writer. Pandora's Pencil Case. Okay, so go ahead and look at that one. We'll try and put a link up. Anyway, David, are you ready to take us into the murky and shark-infested waters of dangerous ideas?
I am indeed. Just really excited just now. Karen Lawson from Scotland's colleges picked up on the Festival of Dangerous Ideas in Sydney, and she's organising a week Festival of Dangerous Ideas, June the 11th to the 16th. And what they're trying to do with it is they're trying to open up the whole area of innovative thinking, starting off with a launch in the National Museum of Scotland, and the idea is that we'll try and identify things which were dangerous ideas in their time and are now commonplace or even essential parts. And we want to ask the question, what are the things that are heresies now? What are the ideas that people maybe think of as dangerous? You know, things like implementing curriculum for excellence as originally intended, that kind of radicalism, which should become part of the everyday commonplace thinking and the way that we approach things. There's a series of events leading on from that, including a Pecha Kucha, which I'm waiting to be enlightened on. We've got an event in...
What?
A Pecha Kucha. It's some Japanese thing, apparently franchise. But there's going to be one of them in Dundee. So there's an exciting and dangerous idea, running a Pecha Kucha in Dundee, an event that nobody will be able to pronounce. And there'll also be an emporium of dangerous ideas. People will be able to buy into the ideas that they've heard of that they think are dangerous but think should stop being dangerous. And we're hoping that we're going to have a teach meet during the week. We're hoping we'll get podcasts. And generally, we want to try and have a week which is challenging people just to think a bit differently and to wake up to the fact that we can be innovative, we can be inventive, and we can be creative.
Mm. Yeah.
Well, that sounds really, really, really interesting, especially the Pecha Kucha. I'm going to go and Google that forthwith. What would you say, David, in your time in education, because you know, you've done lots of jobs from classroom teaching through to, as we talked about earlier, you know, head of service through to, you know, independent advisor. What would you say when you started in your on your career pathway as a teacher, what would you say were dangerous ideas around then that are common practice now?
Well, I think lots of things around relationships and behaviours. I remember being taken aside in my very first year of teaching by the deputy rector in the school to be told that I had no real clear understanding of what the relationship should be between the pupil and the teacher. And he informed me that that relationship should be like the one between the ordinary person and God. a clear delineation. And he accepted that the gap could narrow by the time the pupil was sixth year, which presumably was like entering holy orders in a religious sense. And he was condemnatory of my habit, which I'd developed apparently, of sometimes saying hello to pupils in the corridor before they had said hello to me. So, you know, that around that time, we were still in an area where corporal punishment was in use in Scottish schools. I am revealing my age at this point. And the idea was that that was a perfectly reasonable way to impose discipline on young people. Aside from that, guidance at that point was novel. And the idea that people might engage with young people in a pastoral sense was pretty new at that stage. Reductions in class sizes would have been perceived as a pipe dream. There's just been a massive range of changes over the period of time that I've been involved.
Can I bring in a dangerous idea?
Sure, Steve.
Matthew? And I'll just, because they were speaking, I just reminded of someone who floated a few dangerous ideas, and that was the sociologist Michael Young. I was thinking of the Open University. You know, and the kind of notion that, you know, universities were for anyone.
And in fact, do you remember Brian Boyd, Steve, who was our guest? One of Brian's dangerous ideas that he likes to throw out at talks and lectures is that universities should have no entrance qualifications.
Right.
Which would be the ultimate in Open University. You know, I'm ready to go to uni, I'd like a place. Sure, on you go.
Yeah.
Was it Brian who also had the dangerous idea on the podcast of abolishing Ofsted and HMI?
Yeah, I think it was. Yeah.
And because he had, was it the University of the Third Age as well? I think probably he was a founder of Michael Young. But I was just thinking because he wrote this ironic piece on meritocracy. The rise of meritocracy as a satire, but it was interesting that it became a dangerous idea because it was adopted by Tony Blair in a big way, but rather to Michael Young's chagrin. But
And what are the current dangerous ideas that you're harvesting, David? Which ones should we be being provoked and challenged by at present?
Well, I think there's a whole set of ideas that are perceived as dangerous around self-evaluation and inspection, and the kind of ideas that you've been talking about, that we should have a system based on trust, where we rely on inspiring and enabling teachers rather than intimidating them with the threat of exposure. I sat through a wonderful coming together at a recent head teachers conference in York, where Tim Brighouse spoke first thing in the morning, and was wonderful. And he spoke about a system where it was based on inspiration, enablement and trust. And he did it in the language of narrative and poetry. And he was followed by a representative from Ofsted who spoke about a system where the vision was based on exposure and threat. And it was delivered in the language of Orwellian doublespeak, where satisfactory was no longer satisfactory. Only good was satisfactory, because satisfactory was actually unsatisfactory. And now, henceforth, that which was satisfactory would be classed as requiring improvement. And we agreed that most excellent schools already felt that they required improvement too. But as long as we were getting the language right, and I've been quoting often, I love the idea that Mick Jagger and Michael Wilshaw have got together and made sure that no one can get any satisfactory. It's just a brilliant way to approach it. And the idea that people can be intimidated into improvement, I think, is a dangerous idea, but it's one accepted by the establishment. The idea that we can make progress by trusting people, that's perceived as dangerous.
Matthew, take him to room 101 forthwith.
Yeah, I was just thinking, I was kind of wondering how Eurasia are doing in the war, and sudden need for some victory gin.
Absolutely. I think you already have the victory wine there, so we're fine. We need to
start. Absolutely. And Steve, what about yourself? What are your current dangerous ideas?
Well, I think we've covered a few of them. I mean, I know we talked before about people making international comparisons. And so how about the comparison with Finland, where you don't actually test anybody till they're about to leave school?
Yeah. I have a funny feeling that some teachers are ready for that kind of thinking. You know, it's pretty disgruntled in Scotland with the way the testing is going, because it is moving to being less external until, you know, a later stage anyway. So, you know, we're possibly seeing you know, a bit of a crack in the door we could push against there. But anyway, Jay, I know that you've got no shortage. You've blogged a few of them on our site.
Yeah, my current dangerous idea, and the sound, listeners, you can hear of wine pouring, isn't from my
into no,
my
not bar. Mine.
No, the present dangerous idea is, since it's the holidays, do I have a dram this evening? But no, seriously, my big one that kind of keeps coming back to me and pertinent at the moment, because I'm in the middle of a 2-week holiday, is to tear up the format of the school year. And have a system. I've still got this big issue in my mind of a 6 or 7 week layoff from formal education, which I know some kids go to summer school or camps and things like this, which is super, but not many do. And those who don't are generally those children who could do with a more continuous education. My dangerous idea is to tear up the school year and have something maybe on the lines of 6 or 7 weeks in, then a week off, or a long weekend off, 6 or 7 weeks in, and just have that going throughout the year. A couple of weeks at Christmas, a couple of weeks in the summer, or even, and I think, David, this is something you and I have chatted about before, do what they do in the workplace, you know? Kids book their holidays, or parents on behalf of under 16s, book their holidays. You have a certain entitlement, you've got 6 weeks during the year. When do you want to take them?
Actually, David, you suggested that, didn't you, on one of your previous guest appearances with us?
Ideas from an early stage.
Say that again, David. Sorry, I missed that.
I was throwing the seeds of dangerous ideas from a very early stage in the
conversation. Absolutely, you're doing us a lot of bad, and it's a good thing.
Can I bring in another dangerous idea?
Please. Yeah.
Can I plug Michael Fielding and Peter Moss's book, Radical Education and the Common School? And basically the argument is that if we want to live in a fully functioning, rich, democratic society, then we have to encourage those habits within our institutions. And he talks about examples where, of schools that, you know, have actually taken time out to from what, you know, to create time to be more democratically and accountable to the young people that they serve.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I guess if I was throwing in a danger, I must remember to get that link up as well, Steve. If I was throwing in a dangerous idea, I have so many. In fact, Jay, a lot of our conversations in our professional life are really about these dangerous ideas. But one that I like is removing the compulsory angle of school. I'm intrigued by the idea of what would happen if we just said to kids, you don't want to be here, off you go. And I think it would actually throw up all sorts of complex repercussions that we don't expect. Some of them would be bad and some of them would be fascinating, because certainly some kids would find motivation and come back once they and their families realised it was good for them. But equally well, schools would have to make their schooling very attractive. I think there's a lot to be said for that, but it has to be tied up with the whole idea about making schools more accountable, but not in the way that we do at the moment, which is the, I think you said earlier, David, you know, exposing people, you know, not in that way, but instead setting up positive measurements for schools, you know, about the amount of people that are going to good destinations and, you know, interesting and varied destinations. We always go for the short, easy, you know, how many exams did you pass? Because it's a doddle for people to check and measure. It's very unambitious, isn't it? You know, and it's leaving us, you know, in the past when the dangerous ideas we're talking about are supposed to move us to the future.
In terms of accountability, could we have a vote with your feet week? This is how we judge schools. We have a week where we give every student and pupil across the nation the option of coming to school or not, and we measure attendance in that week.
Yeah, but given our story last week, you know, about the rising number of truants. But don't you think it's remarkable that actually young people are committed to the schools in the numbers they are? Because we say it's compulsory education, but actually we know how easy it is for them to dip out. You know, if they really don't want to go, they'll dip out. Yeah. And actually, you know, the young people I talk to are kind of tremendously committed in a way to trying to find some community or connection to their peers, and schools are the places where they do that, you know. So yeah, I was just thinking, because at the end of the day, what sanctions have we got if people don't want to turn up?
You know, well, so expel them.
Yeah, but it's the sheriff court, you know, that it's the legal requirement. And I do think there's something in the idea that education shouldn't have to be compulsory. If people are instinctively curious, if the human being is indeed a learning machine, and the natural predisposition is to learn, then in theory, education shouldn't have to be compulsory. And I do think you're right. I think we need to ask the question, is it because we're doing something wrong that we need to make it compulsory?
Yeah, it's almost like we've got the confidence in our own product.
Yeah, absolutely.
Anyway, I'm going to just move the conversation to a close. It's been a lengthy one, but a really interesting one, worthwhile. And with everyone's indulgence, ask David to bring this to a close for us. I guess a lot of listeners, maybe even some of our new listeners, David, we know we're growing all the time, so there's always a few new folk might be thinking, why should we be playing with dangerous ideas? You know, this is a critical time in education. We're changing the curriculum in Scotland. We're changing the curriculum and the governance models in England, you know, we really need just focus on practicalities. Can you make a case for why we should be interested in this stuff just now, and maybe link it to, you know, to next steps?
Well, I think what's happening just now in Scotland, arguably, is that we're moving back further and further from the possibility of radical change. And I think one of the biggest risks around with Curriculum for Excellence is it'll finish up being the longest and most difficult gestation period, giving birth to something that really isn't in any sense significantly different from what existed before. I think that's been picked up on by Mark Priestley this week. I think it's been picked up by Lindsay Patterson as well. And I think there's a huge risk that we finish up going through all of this angst, and at the end of it, we have something which really doesn't take us any further forward, and certainly doesn't meet the need of 21st century learners. So there is a need for us to be prepared to take risks. There is a need in a time where change is fast and dramatic, that we need to look at moving forward educationally at a pace that youngsters need, rather than the ones at which we as adults, teachers, educators are prepared to permit. And every change that we've gone through in Scottish education over the last 20, 25 years has been stymied in the rots of workload. I think you either argue that we need to invest heavily in teachers and support for teachers so that we can cope with the workload demanded, or we actually analyse what are the important things that we need to do. Because it's not about changing the books, it's not about changing the worksheets, it's about making sure that we improve the practice, that we create a climate of trust, that we do the things that we know work, and that we genuinely make the difference that needs to be made. Because at the moment, we're not moving from good to great. We're moving from a system which barely meets the needs of the present. And the risk is that we won't move to one which actually meets the demands of the future.
Well, I think everyone in this podcast agrees thoroughly with you. Good to hear these closing words from our very own Pecha Coochie Coochie man, David Cameron. Thank you for guesting with us tonight. Steve, yeah, closing thoughts?
No, I think David said it all.
Jay?
Yeah, but it was good to hear the Danger Mouth himself.
Well, and thank you everyone for joining in tonight. Thank you for listening, and enjoy rolling your eggs on Sunday. Good night.
Thank you.
Good night.
Good night. Good night.